But I think if people stop and think about it, think about this. If you have the lowest unemployment that you've had in a long, long time, and all of a sudden the Fed decides, hey, we're finished raising, we're probably going to start lowering rates. Think about what that does. That probably sets you up for another round of inflation, maybe not tomorrow, but where they push more money out. And then and how are you going to not really press the labor market if all of a sudden you push money into the system over the next 6 or 9 months? And for the idea that we'll stay at this low end of inflation when that happens, probably won't fit together.
Hello and welcome back to Soar Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. I really appreciate you joining us here for this discussion because it's with a guest we had on back in August of 2023, and the comments under the video were fantastic. So we decided we had to bring him back on and discuss the current market environment because it is so fast-paced right now. There's so much to discuss, and let's cut through the noise together. Let's make sense of it all. It's, of course, Ted Oakley of Oxbow Advisors, and I'm looking forward to the discussion with him because I think I've got like 2 pages of notes to discuss with him. We'll see how far we can get. Before I switch over to my guest, please be reminded to hit that subscribe button because I know about 80-85% of you watching are not subscribed. It helps us tremendously, bringing guests like Ted on the program more regularly and invite guests of other great caliber, of course, as well. Now, Ted, it is my great pleasure to welcome you back on the screen. Thank you so much for making the time again.
Thank you, Kai.
Absolutely. Yeah, you were on at the end of August of last year, and a lot has changed. The market, I feel like the pace has picked up tremendously. So we need to recap a little bit and maybe go through some of your predictions that you made at the end of August as well and see what kind of indicators might have changed. But let's start with a general overview, Ted. How is the market doing? How is the economy?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We thought by the end of the third quarter or fourth quarter, we'd probably be in recession, and that did not happen. Which is not unusual for forecasts because it's best you can do is probably 50-50. But the main part was that we thought we would get weaker when we come into this quarter. I think we are. I think certain parts of it are really weak. I mean, if you look at commercial real estate and a number of other things we see weakening, then that's one thing. But we haven't had enough to where, you know, it's affected anything. And I think people are still in a chasing mode in the stock market. Whereas, you know, all of the things point to us still having some sort of really of slowing down an economy. Will we go into a deep, deep recession? I don't know. But I think we're going enough to where it starts to affect earnings. And that's the big thing is the earnings that we're going to see in here. And so looking out into the first and second quarter, you know, what we've got is another what I call another chase on these, you know, top 10 stocks or so. And, you know, that happens at tops in market. And I think that's where we are right now in the first quarter.
Absolutely. Yeah. The S&P 5000 is it's called now, not the S&P 500 anymore, because we're about to break that really important level. It hasn't fallen yet. It seems to be a tough nut to crack right now. But let's stay on that market momentum for now. ARM, a UK chip maker, came out with numbers today. The stock exploded by 50%. How sustainable is the current rally and the current melt up there, Ted?
Well, I think what happens with AI, and I'm not saying it's not something that's very useful, but what happens is that if all of these investors and all of these companies don't have anything else to hang their hat on, they say, well, let's just try to invent ourselves into some sort of AI. I saw this really the same way during .com. I could give you 4 or 5 pages of public companies between 1996 and 2000 that never got through in the next 3 years. Didn't mean that the internet wasn't going to be something spectacular, which it ended up being. But what happens is so many of the players in it are really not what you want. And I think a lot of these companies have built in so much growth that there's no way they can really, in the end, make that work because they've already factored in so much for the next 5 years.
Absolutely. I do agree because let's stay on earnings here as well. Like, do you see some cracks already appearing? Like, of course, NVIDIA and all the others are doing great right now. They're in a boom phase. But let's look at the big box retailers, for example, or any of the other companies that just put out earnings recently. Do you see any cracks?
Well, if you pull out, Kai, if you pull out the top, say, 7 to 10 stocks out of the S&P that have really carried the weight in earnings, when you look at the S&P quote earnings, they've done really well. If you take the bottom 490, they've actually, those estimates and those numbers are negative year on year. And so it's a bifurcated market, but you can't see it because the big ones are so powerful on the whole setup that it camouflages what's going on in the rest of the market. So we see that happening, yeah, but we also see, you know, if you look at Amazon companies like that, they're in the third round of layoffs. It can't be that perfect if you keep on laying people off.
It's a bit surprising to me that the market is shrugging off news like UPS laying off 12,000 people, and the market is like, okay, let's keep going up. Everything seems to be fine. Talk of a U.S. trampoline economy just bounces back up, are making the rounds here. Like, are we just ignoring facts, or is it like, why is it so it's really interesting, like, to analyze, like, why is it so bifurcated? Because the positive news seem to be overshadowing everything else, and we're just ignoring the rest.
Well, I think what happens is, and people don't realize this, but what happens is when you get into these kinds of markets, people are going to go wherever they can make money. They can't, and if you can make money in the top, now in the top six stocks, not the top seven, then that's where you go. Okay. But we're starting to see this. You see it in things like Tesla and ARK. A lot of these things are cracking now. They're not like they were 3 years ago. And I think people will eventually see that it will happen in most of the stocks. They'll slow down some. But no, the problem is the reason I think they don't want to see it is because everyone's begging for a new bull market in bonds and a new bull market in stocks. Let's just go back like we were in the last decade, and I think we'll all be fine, which we don't think that'll be that way this decade.
Absolutely. Like in the last conversation back in August, you mentioned that we're in a stagflationary environment. Has your perception of the market changed at all? Are we still in that same environment, or have the signs changed a little bit?
Well, it comes and goes, because if you have, you know, right now, for example, I know a lot of the things that were in the recession, I mean, when in the inflation side, have been coming down. You have to just face that. That's what's happening. But I think if people stop and think about it, think about this. If you have the lowest unemployment that you've had in a long, long time, and all of a sudden the Fed decides, hey, we're finished raising, we're probably going to start lowering rates. Think about what that does. That probably sets you up for another round of inflation, maybe not tomorrow, but where they push more money out. And then, and how are you going to not really press the labor market if all of a sudden you push money into the system over the next 6 or 9 months? And for the idea that we'll stay at this low end of inflation when that happens, probably won't fit together. So that's the way we sort of see that playing out over the next 6 months or so.
Like, besides the top 10 stocks here, like, margins aren't really expanding, like revenues are not really expanding, like you mentioned. Like you, I know you follow earnings reports quite closely, and we have been through most of the earnings season for Q1, I believe, already. Like, is that something you're witnessing then? And like, is there really that bifurcation? The top 10 are doing great, and the rest is really, you know, struggling.
Well, that's true. I mean, if you look, if you just break them out, you can see it where, you know, they'll come out and say, hey, you know, we've got, you know, trouble in paradise here, but it's not, again, it's not so much the top 10. And then out of the top six, let's face it, a lot of those are saying, hey, we're into AI now and we're going to make it work in our segment. So that's coming to fruition. So everybody just keeps piling into that. Here's one of the big problems, though, Guy. Even in world funds, you look at what's held worldwide, and you look at all of that, these top six or so are big in those as well. So everybody, not just the US, but everybody worldwide owns these stocks. So you can imagine what happens if you ever turn the tide on these and you go the other direction. And by the way, they're not cheap. You know, if you look at the average multiple on this group, it's high. So this idea that, you know, they got a lot of cash, so they're real cheap. Well, that may be true. But if you're paying a high number for earnings, that's not probably going to work out in the long run as well as you think.
One theory I heard, just curious if you sort of subscribe to that as well, is just a lot of the money managers just park their money in the Max 7, in the Magnificent 7, because they're liquid enough. So they can just park their money, and if they need it, they'll shift out again. Is that something, does that theory make sense at all?
Oh, for sure, Guy. That's really what's happening. If you look at most of the overweight long funds or long, even long shorts, they're going to be long that group, and then they're going to overweight it. So that not only can they, you know, beat the benchmark, but they can beat it by a bigger margin. And I think that's where people really don't realize, but that's what's happening. And it happens at tops in the market. I've seen this before, so it's not something new.
Absolutely. I think Bank of America said that, or a study of the Bank of America said that 56% of the importance of is the Fed when making investment decisions and what the Fed does. So 56% of the fund managers look at that. How important is it to you, Ted, and what the Fed is doing? Is like, are we putting maybe too much weight on Fed decisions?
I think we do put too much weight on it. I mean, the Fed, first of all, they all talk too much. Powell talks too much. Every one of the other presidents talk too much. I mean, they're out on the circuit all the time. You know, one of them saying something. You know, they never used to do that. You know, 30 years ago, that's not what happened. And now it is. And unfortunately, every time they say something, everybody's trying to interpret that and that sort of thing. But, if you look at the economy, it will always be affected by interest rates. So they have a big impact. But the biggest part of it is everything's tied to financial now. So, you know, I've never been a time in my career when everything, and I mean everything, was tied to the stock market. And so it's the stock market first, economy second, which is really the wrong way around when you get right down to it.
Absolutely. When we talked in August, you said the Fed might be quite hawkish still, and they haven't raised rates, of course, since they haven't cut either. But the tone has changed, I think, within the Fed and from Chairman Powell here as well. Quite dovish, announcing 3 Fed rate cuts for 2024. The market expects 5 right now. What do you think has changed, and why has the tone changed here of the Fed?
Well, I'm not certain. I wouldn't be surprised, though, that, you know, that if there's been some pressure on him, not maybe political, maybe just from the markets. But the biggest thing is that they didn't really do anything. I mean, they said, hey, you know, we probably finish raising. And most of the time when they start lowering, things are not doing that well. So that's still left to see really what happens. And then they got thrown a curve, because if you look at the last 2 weeks, all of a sudden the rates have kicked back up again. And I think they're a little bit, I think they're thrown a little bit by that. Obviously we don't know what's going to happen, but for us, it's made us keep most of our maturities really short, because I have no idea which way they're headed, but that's still to be seen. But I'm not certain why they were pressured so much to start talking about that in October, but I think it's because they got tired of thinking that there may be some more pain, because we were coming down at the time.
Yeah. Sounds like Yellen and Powell got together in a coffee shop somewhere in a back street and discussed that they need lower rates because the U.S. debt spiral is spinning faster and faster.
That's a problem. She will probably have to fund an outright, looks like to us at least, probably $1.8 to $2 trillion deficit this year. So there'll be some more coming up.
Absolutely. Yeah, U.S. The Congressional Budget Office just published its forecast for U.S. Budget deficits over the next 10 years. I think it was just yesterday or 2 days ago. And they're projecting $2.6 trillion with a T for 2034, which personally I think is a gross underestimate if we maintain the current trajectory. Would you agree, like even this year, like what are your predictions for the U.S. Deficit?
Well, I don't think, Kai, you have anything change until you really hit the wall, until all of a sudden you show up and they can't finance. Now, that's probably not this year, but it will come at some point in time. And when that happens, then your government, your legislature, U.S. Treasury, everybody has to be austere at that point. But that's the only thing that would drive them to have austerity, is the fact that they can't finance. And so the world's saying, you know what? Look, you know, you've run this number up so high, we think we'll pass on buying your bonds right now. When that happens, they're going to have to make some drastic changes.
I don't see any of that changing, as you said, in the near future. Something needs to hit the proverbial fan. So for that to happen. You brought up bond issuance. I think that brings me to a topic du jour as well, is a big U.S. Treasury auction the last few days here as well. Record amount of bonds and treasuries have been issued. Can you recap that for us a little bit? Like, what's the sentiment? Like, did they go through without a hitch, or is there anything we should be worried about?
Well, as far as I know, they sold the issue. I read about it briefly. They sold the issue, okay, and it didn't push them. The markets were already moving on their own because they realized that Powell had came back and sort of backtracked and said, hey, well, you know, we're not going to do anything before March. And maybe, you know, he was on 60 Minutes and all this stuff. And so they just take that sort of what he's saying. But I think what happens is that, at least from our vantage point, is that it's very hard. It'd be very hard for us to take a long bond bet. By that, I mean buying a lot of 20 and 30 year bonds at this level, let's say 430 or whatever, when we have no idea really what that's going to look like over the next 1, 2, or 3 years. And I do think inflation will come and go over that period. It's not like the last decade. And I know people want that to be like that, but I think we'll be in a different time.
I was going to say, like, where do you expect bond yields, especially for the 2 year and 10 year to be headed? Like right now, the 10 year is at 4.15%. The 2 year, actually, I haven't checked. The 2 year is at 4.45. So getting fairly close together again. Like, where do you see it headed, and what could influence higher or lower bond yields?
Well, I have to say, I don't really, on the 10 year, I don't know where it's headed. On the short rates, you can always bet on this. If you're going to keep the Fed funds at 5.5, which they have so far, then that means that probably your 3 month, 6 month, 9 month, 1 year treasuries are going to be hanging in that area. Okay. A little bit lower than that, but you're going to be fairly well protected until they actually start to lower rates. So that part you can function with. You know what to do with. And maybe even go out for us. We go out even 1.5 or 2 years. And we do that on municipal bonds too. But when you get out, excuse me, in the long bond market, then you're making a big bet. 30-year bonds, you're saying, okay, I think this point is where inflation is going to stay or go lower. I think the country's going to do well. I think the credit quality of these states and municipalities is going to do well. So that's what happens. Excuse me.
No, absolutely. And We need to issue more. Like, you know, we had guests on that said, well, we're going to go back to 3% if that happens. But we've also had guests on said, well, by the end of the year, we'll be sitting at a 10% yield again. I think the ramifications for a 10% yield environment are drastic as well. Like,
yeah, I'm the first person to tell you that we don't know. And so if you don't know, you have to be able to make sure that you know what you can know. And what you can know is what I can get over the next 18 or 24 months. I know I can get that. And if I'm wrong and rates go up a lot, all I have to do is wait a year or wait 18 months. I get my money back and I can readjust. You can't do that when you're out 25 or 30 years. I think individuals really don't understand that, but that's one of the problems.
Are we at risk of a U.S. default at all? Is that priced in, or is that a non-risk?
I don't think you're at risk now because they can keep printing money at this stage. It's been pretty easy to do and sell them. And so I don't think so. We're still the strongest in the world. I mean, let's face it, we may have come off the top a little bit and the armor's dented a bit, but we're still the strongest in the world. So you have to keep that in mind.
Absolutely. Financial Times published an interview with Europe's largest fund manager, Amundi, and their managing partner. And he was going on about the bond market developing if a Trump wins the election, for example. And he says, well, it's going to be okay for the first part, but then the bond market is going to tank. Which leads me more to a question, like overall question. I don't want to get political here at all, but what do you expect the U.S. presidential election and the race to the White House is going to do with the markets and bond yield and bonds and the markets in particular?
Well, that's another one, Guy, where I really don't have any idea. I think you have to protect yourself, though. I don't think you can try to estimate what would happen in those. And honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if neither one of these candidates ran. I mean, you know, look at potentially what happens on this situation. One is not so well mentally, in my opinion. He's a little slow. And the other one He might not be around. I don't know. All I'm saying is those are hard things to make an investment decision on. For us, we're just going to make the decision on whether we like the company, whether we like the bond. And that's what we do.
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense, Ted. And what are some of the economic indicators you're looking for in the current environment? And since we chatted at the end of August, has anything changed there, what you're looking at? And are you looking at any other indicators, for lack of a better word?
Well, I find this interesting that a lot of people, I saw somebody yesterday come out and say, one of the big banks, that the consumer is really in great shape. And I question that on this count. Okay. If you look at credit card balances keep going higher and higher, and you keep looking at interest rates going higher and higher on their credit card balances, okay, and buy now, pay later, just the whole thing, then if you're telling me that they had a lot of money that they hadn't spent yet, why would they be doing that? That those two things don't square to me. So I think the consumer is particularly worse off than people think. And I guess I have a leg up on that in that I grew up really poor. And so I can talk to people and ask the right questions, because I've been in that trough before. And I know what to find out. And I think Wall Street themselves, they really have no idea, because they don't know what's happening with the average person. But if you're out in the main street and you're talking to people, you'll find it's not an easy run for them right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Credit card debt at a record high as well. But I got an inside track on the pay later model. It's like, because the delinquency rate is very, very low still. And I haven't heard about them like dropping off or like really starting to fail as well. So is it just a financial innovation, or is it really like an economic indicator as well? Like, can we differentiate there?
Well, I think for buy now, pay later, and obviously I would never own these stocks, because I just think they're an accident waiting to happen. But the thing about it is that if you look at it, I don't think we've gone long enough into it. Because if you look at the big move in buy now, pay later has been in the last 24 months. So, you know, they can make the payments for a while, and then all of a sudden you start to choke down and you can't make it. And that's what I think we see right now, where we're just getting into that sort of thing. If you look at delinquencies right now, all the way around, credit card, autos, other than even student loan, they're higher. They've gone higher and higher and higher. Are they in a place where it's going to throw the economy into deep depths? Not this point, but you've got to track the trend right now, and that's what we're seeing.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate you clarifying that and chiming in on that. You brought up the banking sector, and we discussed that back in August as well. So I'm quickly going to touch on that, because just as today, like the Morningstar cut the rating of the New York Community Bank, I think it has been cut before by another rating agency to junk level. So let's discuss that. How fragile is the banking sector right now, particularly in the U.S.?
Well, I can get a clean look at this because, you know, I've been involved in a community bank for probably 25 years, and I've watched everything that comes down, and it's not anything the size of New York Community. But what happens is that bank had a lot of trouble, I think, anyway, the way they were doing their business. And I think there's a number of banks out there like that, where they probably loaned in the wrong sectors. They don't know really what their credit book looks like. They haven't really gotten that point. And a lot of the people that are running the banks probably have been too zealous to make money and earnings, etc. So that's where it's headed. But one of the biggest problems, though, Guy, is that this banking area, not only medium and small banks, but large banks, they're so overregulated now. They're ruining this system from Washington. And that, I think that's the biggest problem the banks are going to have. And that's why you see private credit pop up so much, is because the banks are getting so overregulated they can't do anything.
No. Interesting. Okay. So are you worried about a big bank crisis? Like, I'm always looking for the straw that breaks the camel's back. We briefly talked commercial real estate, we talked the banking crisis, but if it's advertised and we all know about it, it can't be the straw that breaks the camel's back. And maybe another anecdote is the Evergrande disaster in China, which I thought would have more of an effect on the overall economy worldwide. It's barely a side note or footnote in the mainstream media right now. And that's a $300 billion disaster that's being unwound right now, with a lot of sovereign debt holders in the company that need to be unwound. What should we be afraid of, Ted? That's probably the right question to ask.
Well, I think the thing that you want to watch now is high yield debt. You know, long time ago when I was on Wall Street, we had a saying, or they had, the old timers had a saying, that when the spreads, the yield between the high yield and the U.S. Treasury are really tight, really close, you buy the Treasury. When they're really, really wide, in other words, you make a lot more money on high yield, you buy the high yield. Well, right now, they're real tight. They're real close together. And so there'll probably be some pain in the high yield market over the next 5 to 10 years that people are not expecting. And I think that's what they should be aware of. In the bank side, you know, they've all gotten locked up on long paper, and I'm not certain they can get out of it. That's a problem, because a lot of them have 15, 20, 25 year paper, and those rates are not going back like they were. You know, you're not going back to those rates before. So I think they drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, and they're just hung up in those bonds, and they're going to have to wait it out, if anything.
I think we need to differentiate a little bit. When you mentioned high yields, I think we need to quickly explain what that means to our audience as well, because I had a discussion just yesterday. That's why it's top of mind for me, is about corporate bonds as well, and how they factor in into everything. Is that a place you would invest right now, for example, as well? Or you wouldn't?
Well, if we saw a corporate that we liked, we would. The thing about it is that corporate spread is not that big over the Treasury either. And then we find that we can buy 1 and 2 and 3 year tax-free bonds that are very high quality, by the way. And when you net that out in a high bracket, that's even more than the Treasury. So it doesn't make sense for us to try to get that extra half a point on a corporate when a corporate bond could have a problem, you know. And so that's where we stand on it. It's not that we don't ever buy corporates. We buy them, but the spread's not big enough for us to do that.
Yeah. Well, the risk is too high on the corporate side, I think, in comparison. You have a 4.5, where we just discussed bond yields, U.S. Treasury yields. Why would you bother buying corporate bonds if the risk of default is actually way higher? So,
yeah, but the high yield side is, I think, what people don't understand. I mean, people just don't realize that high yield never pans out. There's always companies that go under and they drop off. If you took every high yield piece of paper today and you say, I'm going to index that, and you looked at that index 3 or 4 years from now, you'd find that that index didn't stay up with the yield because the companies went broke. That's the problem you have with high yield.
Absolutely. No, I get that. Ted, we also talked commodities and gold last time. Might as well do that again, because it's been an interesting market. Gold has been hanging in there over $2,000, over 50 days over that level now. So it's almost fair to say, well, that $2,000 level seems to be the new floor, not the ceiling anymore. Where do you stand on gold and the commodities in general, Ted?
Well, we own gold, and we have three strategies, and two strategies we own gold, the bullion, and then one strategy we own the miner. And we have a couple of miners in the other two as well. I think what's thrown people is that with gold at a new high, the miners haven't caught up with it. Doesn't mean they won't eventually. What we see in here, though, is if you do have a market correction, you'll know that gold and the miners will go with it. They do not hold up through a market sell-off in most cases. However, they usually come back very quickly. And I think if you want to hold gold, I think you have to think like this: I'm just going to hold it. I'm not going to try to set it to try to beat a benchmark or anything like that. If you look back over 50 years of gold, the main thing to do was just hold it and try to look at it as a currency and just go with that and not try to get too hung up on the ups and downs of it, because it's going to go up and down. I could see gold in the decade go a lot higher, but you know, you're going to have to wait on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. You took away my next question there, is like, where do you see gold headed? But like short term, let's say the next 12 months, do you have any prediction, anything like any inkling?
You know, it depends on, I think, a lot of things, but if typically, if you see inflation rear its head again and the dollar fall, okay, and you get in a situation like that, you could probably see gold come alive. I think people are looking at it worldwide and saying, you know, I don't trust these governments. I don't trust these fiat currencies of all these governments. So I think I'll just hold some gold right now.
Absolutely. And it seems like the Eastern nations are following that mantra to a T here. So buying, the central banks buying up a lot of gold and keeping up the gold market, because we are still seeing outflows out of the ETFs. Yeah. So the retail investor is selling while the central banks are buying. Explain that one to me. Yeah. I don't get it, Ted. But
No, I think they're tired of being tied to the dollar. And it got exacerbated when President Biden decided he would hold the money on the Russians. And then everybody else looked up and said, well, if they would take those $300 billion, they'll certainly take my money too. And everybody, if you look at the BRICS, South American countries, there's probably 11, 12, 14 countries right now that if they had a choice, they would have a different singular currency, I think, and trade it that way. So they buy gold. I think that'll be part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. See how that plays out. Because we talked, I think actually we talked right during that BRICS meeting. So we'll see how that plays out in the long run. Ted, very last question. If I were to come to you tomorrow and say, hey, Ted, I have $100,000 to invest, how would you allocate my money right now?
Well, right now, it's fairly easy for us to do. You know, it's, of course, depend on how old you are, Kai. So, let's just say you're 40 years old. I'll use that example.
So you're off by 17 days. So, okay. Yeah.
Let's just say you're 40 years old. You know, obviously, you're going to want to own some stock. Now, you want to be fully allocated right now? Probably not. So we would probably do something like hold you in 50 to 75% bulletproof to some items that we own in some of our high income accounts that are gas pipelines, all sorts of things that pay a high cash flow. But it would be generally that 75% is not going to fluctuate a lot. And the 25% we would put in the market. And I would probably caution to tell you that we wouldn't get the whole 25 in at one time. It would take us a while. And then, you know, if we had really cheaper prices, we don't so much look at the market as we do companies. But if our companies got really cheap that we like, we would probably up that from 25 to 50 and then maybe even go higher at your age. If you were 75 years old, just flip that. You know, we would do probably close to 80%. Bulletproof, maybe 15 or 20% in the market. And we would just have to go that way because when you're 80 years old, you don't have a chance to go out and make it again. So you have to look at it that way.
No, fantastic, Ted. I really appreciate you humoring that question and, breaking it down. I asked the same question Lance Roberts the other day as well. And I like your answers. It makes a lot of sense and very sensible, in my opinion. So I trust you there.
Well, you have to look at it, Kai. If you just took right now, okay, let's just say you take the earnings of the S&P, and if I took what everybody expects they'll make this next year, well, we're still selling at 21 times. And so you don't start bull markets. I mean, really good bull markets, they don't start from that number. They start from something in the low teens or even single digits in some cases. But that's the difference of where we are. And I think people realize that they're just so mesmerized with these top stocks that they can't really see through that. And that's the problem you have right now.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Ted, I truly enjoyed this conversation. Where can we find more of your work? Where can we follow you?
You know, Kai, the best place is oxbowadvisors.com because everything's there. I mean, if you look at everything we do, our newsletter, interviews, I think there's 10 books there I've written that there are certain topics that people might be interested in. I mean, I said, our market letter's on there and you'll see, but I said in the market letter, I said, hey, you know, I expect in the first quarter that you get this close, you'll probably make new highs. And that's about what we think we're seeing right now, but we just don't think it'll last.
No, absolutely. Really close to 5,000. Let me check before we hang up here. Ted, we are at, where's the index? 49.95. So yeah, we're getting close. Fantastic. Ted, thank you so much for your time. I truly appreciate it. Fantastic insights. And we'll have to get you back on in Q2, discuss where we're at and where the market is sitting. So really appreciate that. And I clicked away. Hold on. I opened. There we go. Everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. Really, really appreciate it. If you haven't done so, please hit that subscribe button. Hit that like button as well. Especially that like button tells us if we had the right guest on, if we asked the right questions and covered topics that you are interested in. And if we didn't, leave a comment so we can change that, so we can discuss what you're interested in and maybe geared towards more towards your interests. We really appreciate your time. We, of course, thank Ted for joining us and everybody else. We'll be back with lots more. Good luck out there.